Poised in a hatchway, Peter counted the bright orange spurts of gunfire. There were 5 of them, but there was no sound of passing shot. No thump of the strike. "Get lower," he shouted at the engineer, reinforcing the order with urgent hand signals. And obediently the big machine sank down upon the racing Austin. Peter gathered himself, judging his moment carefully, and when it came, he launched himself clear of the hatchway, and his guts seemed to cram into his throat as he dropped. He dropped with all 4 limbs spread and braced to land together. But for a moment he thought he had misjudged it and would fall behind the Austin into the metalled roadway to be crushed and shredded by the forward impetus of the low-flying helicopter. Then the Austin swerved and checked slightly, and Peter crashed into its roof with stunning force. He felt the metal buckle and sag under him, and then he was rolling and slipping sideways. His whole left side was numbed by the force of the impact, and he clutched wildly with his right hand, his fingernails tearing at the paintwork. But still, he slid towards the edge, his legs kicking wildly in dark, rushing space. At the last instant before he was hurled into the roadway, his clawed fingers hooked in the framework of the roof rack, and he hung bat-like from his one arm. It had taken only a small part of a second, and immediately the driver of the Austin realized that there was a man on the roof. He slewed the little car from one side of the road to the other, short, wrenching turns that brought her over on 2 outside wheels before slamming back and twisting the other way. The tires squealed harsh protest, and Peter was flung brutally back and forth, the muscle and tendons of his right arm popping and creaking with the strain of holding on. But feeling was flooding swiftly back into his numbed left side. He had to move quickly. He couldn't survive another of those wrenching swerves, and he gathered himself, judged the Austin's momentum, and used it to roll and grab with his free hand. At the same moment, the toes of his soft boots found purchase on one of the struts of the roof carrier, and he pressed himself belly down, clinging with both arms and legs to the wildly swinging machine. The Austin checked and steadied as a steep turn appeared ahead in the arc lights of the helicopter which still hung over them. The driver shot the car into the corner, and ahead of them was a long extended drop as the road twisted down the hills towards the coast. Peter half lifted himself and was about to slide forward when the metal 6 inches in front of his nose exploded outwards, leaving a neatly punched hole through the roof, and tiny fragments of flying metal stung his cheek. At the same moment, the concussion of the pistol shot beat in upon his eardrums. The driver of the Austin was firing blindly up through the coachwork, and he had misjudged Peter's position above him by inches. Peter threw himself desperately to one side, for an instant almost losing his grip on the struts of the carrier, and another pistol bullet clanged out through the metal roof. That one would have taken him through the belly, and Peter had a fleeting image of the kind of wound that would have been inflicted. The bullet would have been mushroomed and deformed by the roof and would have broken up inside his body. Desperately, Peter threw himself back the opposite way, trying to outguess the gunman below him, and once again the crash of the shot and the metal roof erupted in a little jagged pockmark, flecking the paintwork away so the rim of the bullet hole shone like a polished silver shilling. Again it would have hit him if he hadn't moved. Peter rolled again, tensing his belly muscles in the anticipation of the tearing, paralyzing impact, expecting the gunshot, which didn't come. Only then he remembered the wasted pistol fire the driver had thrown up at the hovering helicopter. He had emptied his pistol, and as the realization dawned on Peter, there was another completely compelling sound. Very faint in the drumming rush of the wind and the engine roar, but unmistakable. It was the sound of a young girl screaming, and it galvanized Peter as nothing else, even the threat of death, could have done. He came up on toes and fingers like a cat, and he went forward and to the right until he was directly above the driver's seat. The girl screamed again, and he recognized Melissa Jane's voice. There was no question of it, and he slipped the Walter from its quick-release holster and cocked the hammer with the same movement. One glance ahead, and they were rushing down on another turn in the narrow road. The driver would be using both hands to control the swaying and bucking little machine. Now, he told himself, and dropped forward, so that he was peering backwards and upside down through the windscreen, directly into the driver's pale face, and at a distance of only 18 inches. In the thousandth part of a second, Peter recognized the dark, wolfish features and the cold, merciless eyes of the killer. He had hunted this man for many years and studied his photograph endlessly when the hunting of the Provo terrorists had been his life's work. Gilly O'Shaughnessy was driving with both hands, the pistol still gripped in one of them and the chamber open for reloading. He snarled at Peter like an animal through the bars of its cage, and Peter fired with the muzzle of a Walter touching the glass of the windscreen. The glass starred into a glittering sheet, white and opaque, and then it collapsed inwards with the force of the wind, filling the interior of the Austin with flying diamond chips of sparkling glass. Gilly O'Shaughnessy had thrown up both hands to his face, but bright blood burst from between them, spattering his chest and soaking swiftly into the lank black hair. Still hanging upside down across the Austin's cab, Peter thrust the Walter in through the shattered windscreen until it almost touched the man's body, and he fired twice more into his chest, where the explosive Velex bullets would break up against bone and would not over-penetrate to harm anybody else in the interior. Melissa Jane's scream still rang clearly in his ears as he killed Gilly O'Shaughnessy. He did it as coldly as a veterinary surgeon would put down a rabid dog, and with as little pleasure. And the bullets punched Gilly O'Shaughnessy back on the bucket seat, head lolling from side to side. And Peter expected the howl of the engine to cut out now, as the dead man's foot slipped from the accelerator. It didn't happen. There was no change in the engine beat. The body had slid forward and jammed, the knee under the dashboard, bearing down fully on the pedal, and the little car flew down the slope of the hill, the stone walls on each side blurring past as though down a tunnel in the depths of the earth. Peter wriggled forward and thrust both arms through the shattered windscreen and caught the untended wheel as it began to spin aimlessly. He checked the Austin and swung her back into the road, but she had been driven to her limits, rocking and swaying crazily before she righted herself and flew down the hill. It was almost impossible to judge the control needed to keep her on the road. Peter was hanging head down, gripping only with knees and toes, and he had to manipulate the wheel from this inverted position, with his upper arm sawing across the teeth of jagged glass still remaining in the frame of the windscreen. The wind whipped and clawed him, and Gilly O'Shaughnessy's body flopped forward bonelessly onto the wheel, jamming it at a critical moment, so that while Peter used one hand to shove him backwards, the side of the Austin touched the stone wall with a screech of rending metal and a shower of orange sparks. Peter wrenched her back onto the road, and she began a series of uncontrolled broadsides, swinging wildly from one side to side, touching the wall with another jarring shock, then swinging back sideways to bounce over the verge, then back again. She was going over, Peter knew it, and he would be crushed under the metal roof and smeared along the abrasive surface of the macadam road. He should jump now and take his chances, but grimly he stayed with the crazed machine, for Melissa Jane was in her, and he could not leave. He survived one more skid, and ahead Peter had the glimpse of a barred wooden gate in the wall. Deliberately he turned the front wheels into the direction of the next skid, no longer trying to counteract it, but aggravating it, steering directly for the gate, and the Austin smashed into it. A wooden beam cartwheeled over Peter's head, and a scalding cloud of steam from the shattered radiator stung his face and hands. And then the Austin was into the open field, bouncing and thudding over the rocks that studded it, the drag of soft muddy earth slowing her, and the steep slope of the hillside against her. Within 50 feet, the front end dropped heavily into a drainage ditch, and the little car shuddered to a halt, canted at an abandoned angle. Peter slipped over the side and landed on his feet. He jerked open the rear door, and a man half fell from the cab. He dropped onto his knees in the mud, blubbering incoherently, and Peter drove his right knee into his face. Bone and cartilage crunched sharply, and there was a crackle of breaking teeth. His voice was cut off abruptly, and as he dropped, Peter chopped him with the stiffened blade of his right hand. A controlled blow, judged finally to immobilize but not to kill, and before the unconscious body dropped, Peter had gone in over it. He lifted his daughter out of the Austin, and the frail, wasted body felt insubstantial in his arms, and the heat of fever and infection burned against his chest. He was possessed by an almost uncontrollable desire to crush her body to him with all the strength of his arms. But instead, he carried her as though she were made of some precious and fragile substance, stepping carefully over the uneven, rocky surface of the field to where the helicopter was settling cumbersomely out of the darkness. The Thor doctor was still aboard her. He jumped clear before the helicopter touched and ran towards Peter in the brilliant glare of the landing lights. Peter found he was crooning softly. "It's all right now, darling. It's all over now. It's all finished, my baby. I'm here, little one." Then Peter made another discovery. It was not sweat running down his cheeks and dripping from his chin, and he wondered unashamedly when last it was he had wept. He couldn't remember, and it didn't seem important, not now, not with his daughter in his arms. Cynthia came down to London, and Peter relived some of those horrors from their marriage. "Everybody around you always has to suffer, Peter. Now it's Melissa Jane's turn." He could not avoid her, nor her martyred expression, for she was always at Melissa Jane's bedside. While he bore her recriminations and barbed accusations, he wondered that she had ever been gay and young and attractive. She was 2 years younger than he was, but she already had the shapeless body and greying mind that made her seem 20 years older. Melissa Jane responded almost miraculously to the antibiotics, and although she was still weak and skinny and pale, the doctor discharged her on the third day, and Peter and Cynthia had their final degrading haggling and bargaining session, which Melissa Jane settled for them. "Mummy, I'm still so afraid. Can't I go with Daddy, just for a few days?" Finally, Cynthia agreed with sighs and the pained airs that left them both feeling a little guilty. On the drive down to Abbott's Yew, where Stephen had invited them for as long as was necessary for Melissa Jane's convalescence, she sat very quietly beside Peter, her left hand still in the sling and the finger wearing a small, neat white turban. She spoke only after they'd passed the Heathrow turnoff on the M4. "All the time, I knew you were going to come. I can't remember much else. It was always dark and giddy-making. Things kept changing. I'd look at a face and it would fade away. And then we'd be somewhere else." "It was the drug they were giving you," Peter explained. "Yes, I know that. I remember the prick of the needle." Reflexively, she rubbed her upper arm and shivered briefly. "But even with the drug, I always knew you were going to come. I remember lying in the darkness, listening for your voice." There was the temptation to try to pretend it had never happened, and Melissa Jane had not spoken about it until now. But Peter knew she must be allowed to talk it out. "Would you like to tell me about it?" he invited gently, knowing that it was essential to the healing process. He listened quietly as she spilled out drug-haunted memories, disjointed scraps of conversation and impressions. The terror was back in her voice when she spoke of the Dark One. "He looked at me sometimes. I remember him looking at me." And Peter remembered the cold killer's eyes. "He's dead now, darling." "Yes, I know. They told me." She was silent for the moment, and then went on. "He He was so different from the one with grey hair. I liked him. The old one, his name was Dr. Jamieson. How did you know that? Peter asked. That's what the dark one called him. She smiled. Dr. Jamieson, I remember he always smelt like cough mixture, and I liked him. The one who had done the amputation and would have taken her hand as well, Peter thought grimly. I never saw the other one. I knew he was there, but I never saw him. The other one? Peter turned to her sharply. Which other one, darling? There was another one, and even the dark one was afraid of him. I knew that. They were all afraid of him. You never saw him? No, but they were always talking about him and arguing about what he would do. Do you remember his name? Peter asked, and Melissa Jane frowned in concentration. Did he have a name? Peter prompted. Usually they just talked about him. But yes, I remember now. The dark one called him Casper. Casper? No, not that. Not Casper. Oh, I can't remember. Her voice had risen, a shrill note in terror that ripped at Peter's nerves. Don't worry about it. He tried to soothe her, but she shook her head with frustration. No, not Casper, a name like that. I knew he was the one who really wanted to hurt me. They were just doing what he told them. He was the one I was truly afraid of. Her voice ended with a sob, and she was sitting bolt upright in the seat. It's all over now, darling. Peter swung into the verge of the road and braked to a halt. He reached for her. She was rigid in his arms, and at his touch she began to shake uncontrollably. Peter's alarm flared, and he held her to his chest. Caliph, she whispered. That's his name. Caliph. And she relaxed against him softly and sighed. The shaking stopped slowly. Peter went on holding her, trying to control the terrible consuming waves of anger that engulfed him. And it was some little time before he realized suddenly that Melissa Jane had fallen asleep. It was as though uttering the name had been a catharsis for her terror, and now she was ready to begin the healing inside. Peter laid her gently back in the seat and covered her with the Angora rug before he drove on, but every few seconds he glanced across to make sure she was at peace.